Families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The 2007-2008 season brochure and KrannertCenter.com announcements of the 2007-2008 season of guest artists are now available.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. Until recently, people in the eastern United States enjoyed an abundance of water. In fact, rainfall in this part of the country was so dependable that for a long time people thought that irrigation would just never be necessary. However, in recent years, that has begun to change. In parts of the eastern United States, drought and overuse have begun to threaten supplies of water. And in fact, today, water managers in many eastern states believe that even without drought, they will see water shortages within a decade. Our guest for the program this morning is Cynthia Barnett, and we'll be talking about her recent book. It's titled Mirage, Florida and the Vanishing Water of the Eastern United States. It's a book that takes Florida, the state of Florida, as a kind of a case study, and she writes in the book that perhaps nowhere have water shortages been either more puzzling or more prophetic than in the state of Florida. The book has just recently come out from the University of Michigan Press, and I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. Just a little bit more about our guest. Cynthia Barnett has been a reporter and editor at newspapers and magazines now for over 20 years. Since 1998, she has written for Florida Trend magazine, where she covers investigative, environmental, public policy, and business stories. She has also worked as the Metro editor of the Gainesville Sun, that's in Gainesville, Florida, and also was a senior reporter at the News and Observer of Raleigh, North Carolina. She has a bachelor's degree in journalism and master's degree in American history with specialization in environmental history, both of them from the University of Florida. She's won a number of awards for her work, including three investigative reporting prizes in the Green Eye Shades, which recognizes the best journalism in 11 southeastern states. She is joining us this morning by telephone. She makes her home in Gainesville, Florida. Ms. Barnett, hello.
Hi, David. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, I really appreciate you being here on the show. I think that this is a very important issue. And I think that the bottom line is here, as I've said, even though that the book concentrates primarily, the case study is Florida, the place where you live, it is the case that here in this part of the country, where we are in the Midwest, in the eastern United States, where historically, we've taken water for granted. We're just at the point where we're just not going to be able to do that anymore. And that the kind of growth we've had, population growth, development, demands on water by individuals and families and industry has grown to the point now where it's a serious problem. And no longer can we take availability of water for granted the way that we have now for so long.
Absolutely. And as you point out, Florida is the microcosm for Mirage, but I go all over the country to report on water shortages and lands of plenty, one of those being the Great Lakes. I actually wrote the book and researched the book during a fellowship at the University of Michigan. And, you know, while in Michigan, I learned a lot about threats to the Great Lakes and saw the concern that Great Lakes residents have for their water supply, especially concerns about potential diversion of water. There was a great billboard. I don't think it's up anymore, but when I was there, your listeners may have seen this enormous billboard looming over the interstates that says, "Back off, suckers." And it's a picture of a California surfer, a Texas cowboy, and a sombrero-wearing New Mexican and a Utah skier, and they're all slurping Great Lakes water out of enormous straws. So obviously this is on people's mind, and it's of a concern nationally, but the argument in my book is that, you know, the great water wars conflicts and shortages that were once unique to the arid West have now moved to the eastern half of the United States, a bizarre occurrence given how much water we had to begin with.
Mm-hmm. And just again to underscore the issue, what we're talking about is there indeed may have been problems from time to time with drought, and certainly
yes.
in Florida there were serious problems with drought. But really the big problem here is overuse of the resource
yes.
that has to do with, again, increasing demand because of development.
Yes.
We're also, I'm sure, seeing increasingly industrial demand. And it's simply the fact that we're, you know, for example, if we're talking about groundwater, we're simply pumping it out of the ground faster than that resource can be recharged.
David, you're absolutely right. And again, just taking Florida as a microcosm, we were blessed with an incredible amount of groundwater in what's known as the Floridan Aquifer, and we are literally pumping more out than the rainfall and the evapotranspiration, all the natural systems, including the rivers that come into Florida. We're doing more groundwater pumping than all of those natural systems are putting back, and I argue that this is the case in many parts of the eastern United States, that a population, a combination of population growth and unwise development patterns have resulted in a crisis of groundwater overpumping.
Hmm. What you write about, you start out writing about in the book, that it is particularly kind of ironic about Florida, is that here we have a place where water shortages, demand for water has become a problem. Mm-hmm. This in a place where one time the problem was seen to be too much water.
Yes, at statehood in 1845, Florida was nearly three-fourths submerged. So we spent 150 years getting rid of water at every single turn. We dug canals. We drained wetlands. We did everything we could to get rid of the fresh water and send it out to the sea. And so basically, we got rid of too much. Now the very same people, you know, the development community, the same people who got rid of all that water have now become desperate to find it.
The one of the things that's just really significant, and certainly it's true of Florida, and it may well be true also of some other coastal regions of the East, and
yes.
perhaps no matter where you go, is the increase in population. And here,
yes.
particularly in the state of Florida, you can see, especially starting around 1950, I
yes.
think, this dramatic, very dramatic increase in population, as more people have wanted to settle there, people have wanted to retire there, and of course it's an enormous tourist destination. So during that period, roughly 50-year period between 1950 and 2000, an enormous number of people came to Florida, and the population grew very, very significantly.
Yes, I mean, population growth is definitely the backdrop of the story, not only in Florida, but in many coastal areas of the United States. And I write a lot about saltwater intrusion, because that's another thing. You mentioned drought and the fact that drought is natural and we've always suffered through droughts. Saltwater intrusion is another thing that naturally occurs in Florida and all over the Atlantic coast. But the population growth has been so intense. You know, you now have... We have 17 million people statewide, but just in South Florida, on this sort of really delicate and fragile tip of the peninsula, we have 7 million people making their home, and they're all relying, they actually rely on a different aquifer called the Biscayne Aquifer, and it's that sheer number of people all relying on the same water source that has resulted in this crisis. And saltwater intrusion is just one more thing that happens when you take out more than nature replenishes. And I'm looking now at a map of the eastern seaboard where the U.S. Geological Survey has identified hot spots for saltwater intrusion.
Mm-hmm.
And USGS reports saltwater is threatening freshwater aquifers in Miami and Jacksonville. Then you're going up the coast. It's happening in Brunswick, Georgia, Beaufort, and Hilton Head in South Carolina, northeastern North Carolina, the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland and Virginia, Delaware River and Bay in New Jersey and Delaware, Long Island, New York, and Cape Cod, Massachusetts. So, you know, you talk about population growth. All of these hot spots, or most of these hot spots where we're seeing saltwater intrusion into freshwater wells, are happening in places that have seen intense population growth along the U.S. east coastline.
Yeah, and with certainly, as you say, with very significant environmental facts, because
exactly.
they're places where people, delicate environments, places where people had not lived before, certainly not in that concentration, and so it's had consequences for the environment. And of course, as we know too, it's put population in a place where it's vulnerable to weather.
Absolutely,
that also can have very serious consequences as well.
Absolutely, we've really put ourselves in the path now of hurricanes, as we saw in the tragic story of Hurricane Katrina. And it wasn't just the hurricane hitting the land. It was the fact that we have gotten rid of so many wetlands in Louisiana and other parts of the U.S. coast. You know, a wetland will hold back a storm surge. I think the scientists say that for every mile of wetland destroyed, it would have held back the storm surge 10 feet. And so, you know, it's not just that we've moved to the coasts, it's that we've moved to the coasts and developed them in a very unwise manner, taking out the wetlands and the other, you know, the trees and other parts of the coastline. We know they're there to provide nursery habitat for fish and wildlife, but we have to remember that they were also protecting us from things like hurricanes and storm surges.
And two, just and going back to the water issue, not only are wetlands significant because they're your buffer against something like a hurricane.
They store water.
They store water.
Exactly.
If you lose, if you dry them up, if you dredge them, if you drain them, if you pave them over, then what happens is that the rainfall that you do get, it just ends up running off, and it eventually runs off into the ocean, where otherwise it would be like a sponge. It would soak it up and hold it.
Exactly, and I think that is really the perfect way to describe what's happened in Florida. If you consider that this place was nearly three-fourths submerged, as I mentioned, and now so many of those wetlands are gone, and there aren't as many places for the aquifer to be recharged. You know, the asphalt and other surfaces do, as you say, mean that water is running off and not being held, not just for humans, but for fish and wildlife and natural systems.
Let me just take a moment here to introduce again our guest for anybody who's just maybe tuned in, Cynthia Barnett. She's a longtime newspaper and magazine journalist, and she is the author of a recently published book. It is Mirage, subtitled Florida and the Vanishing Water of the Eastern United States. It is published by the University of Michigan Press and makes the argument that growth and development and increased demand for water means that water shortages and possibly even conflicts over water, the kinds of things that we have been seeing now for some time in the West, we are more and more likely to see those same things, shortages and conflicts over water in the East, in the historically wet eastern part of the United States. And a lot of the book is indeed about Florida. That's her test case. That's where her case study. That's where she lives. But it does go beyond that and talk in many parts more generally about water issues in the eastern United States. So if you are interested, you can seek the book. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore or the library. And questions here on the program are welcome too. We have somebody ready to go. Others are welcome to give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. Here is someone to talk with. We'll bring them into the conversation. Someone in Urbana, and it's line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I don't doubt the truth of what you have laid out as the water situation down there. And I'm betting those in water engineering and the Hydrologic scientists have known this was happening for some time. But what has been the response of powerful business interests and the politicians that they support to this news?
That's a good question. As I say, the same business interests that drained the water to begin with, you know, in the name of economic development, realized around 2001 that this, they drain too much, this has become a crisis, we've got to find new sources of water. And so several things have happened. They have looked at moving water from the more water-rich northern part of the state to the southern part of the state, and that, of course, is very controversial. And so the emphasis now, see, and this is not just in Florida, this is the case in Florida, Texas, and California, basically the entire Sun Belt, seems to be putting a lot of stock into desalination. And I just wrote a cover story for my magazine on the largest desalination plant in North America. It's been built on the shores of Tampa Bay, and it is 5 years late in opening, and it's also $50 million over budget, and it's still not quite working right. And so, you know, people in the Sun Belt, the Texas Governor Rick Perry is particularly excited about desalination, and there's a lot of study and a lot of planning going on in Texas. But when you look to the Tampa Bay desalination plant, it is a cautionary tale. It was supposed to produce the cheapest desalted water anywhere in the world. It was supposed to be $1.71 per 1,000 gallons. It's currently $3.19 per 1,000 gallons. And again, it's still not working quite right. And so I argue in Mirage that we should be considering a soft path versus the hard path of huge new water projects and huge new water infrastructure.
Is anyone down there thinking of actually limiting development?
Limiting development?
Yeah, not a chance, eh?
This is a bad word in Florida. I think that even people who would like to limit development just don't see that as a possibility. I think even the feeling among the environmental community is that development will become self-limiting if we run out of water. And so, you know, when it comes to these large infrastructure projects, I argue that the eastern United States should look to the west and sort of learn from the mistakes of America's water history, where large infrastructure projects often cost much more than build, and where, you know, rivers were so over-allocated that there's now not enough for legal users, less fish and wildlife during times of drought. And in fact, many of these large infrastructure projects are being taken down. I think we've seen some 500 dams taken down around the United States in the name of ecological restoration. So it's almost like we're doing the same things in the eastern U.S. that we've already done that didn't exactly work in the West.
I believe you, but I hope other people will listen. Thank you.
Right. Thank
you. Others are other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the statistics here that I'm just amazed by, you have a chart here showing right now who are the biggest water users.
Yes.
And the biggest user of water right now in Florida is agriculture.
Yes.
But it is also, you say in that same section, that it is predicted that by 2020, farmers will no longer be the biggest water users in Southwest Florida. It will, in fact, be golf courses.
That is amazing, and that's actually in a sliver of Florida. That's in the southwest part of the state, where we are seeing more and more agricultural acres being converted to golf courses. But the thing that's most fascinating to me about the agriculture situation, you know, farmers have used the lion's share of water in American history, And in the West, as agricultural acreage is converted to urban use, water consumption always goes down when that happens because farmers do use so much. Ironically, in Florida, in the spots where agriculture is converting to urban use, the consumption is actually going up, and that's, you know, that's alarming. That shouldn't be the case. That is a sign that we aren't taking conservation seriously enough, and I think we aren't all over the eastern United States, and I think the reason is that we, as you said, water's always been abundant. We've always, you know, everywhere you look, even now during the drought, when I look around, I see lakes and ocean, and you know, there's water everywhere you look, so it's sort of hard to believe. It's hard to wrap your mind around this new reality, and so we sort of haven't caught up with some of the more arid parts of the country on serious conservation, but I think we'll have to.
Yeah. Well, I think, as you say, I expect there probably are people who are conscious of this, but that probably most of us, and I would include myself, don't think very much about it. I was very struck by, at one point I was reading a book where you cited the statistic that the average person uses 90 gallons of water a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it and I thought, oh, no way. There's no way I could use that much water.
Did you pull your water bill?
I absolutely did.
Good. What'd you find?
In our house, we have two of us. We use 200 gallons a day.
Really?
We're slightly above the average. And, uh-huh. and I started thinking about it, and I kind of think actually one of the big culprits is we have an old toilet.
An old toilet is a huge culprit.
And I'm sure that we could, yeah.
Yeah. You'll go out and you'll buy an efficient toilet, and you'll be amazed at the water use going down and your costs going down as well. And there's some neat research out of an organization called the Pacific Institute in California, which calculates things like how much water we could save if we converted the old toilets to high-efficiency toilets. And just one statistic I remember reading recently, they said if the state of California converted its older toilets to the new high-efficiency toilets, they would be able to save the amount of water that Californians use each day from the Hetch Hetchy Dam. Hmm. So these are the kinds of things I'm talking about. Why would you build, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in desalination plants before you replace the toilet? It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and I was really taken aback because you know, we have a small house. There are only two of us. We're not doing that much laundry or showering. We don't water our grass, and I would have thought, well, how much water could we possibly use?
Right,
I was absolutely
well. Good for you for doing that. And when this book was about to come out, my husband said, "Oh my gosh, I need to calculate our water use because I don't want, I don't want you to be able to be criticized for saying these things." And because we feel like we use way too much water, we have two small children, and they take baths, and they want to go outside and run in the sprinklers, and so he calculated ours, and ours was about 69 gallons per person per day. And we think that's a lot. We know the kids are taking baths, and we're doing too much laundry, and there's room for everyone. There's room for everyone to do a little something. And if you can imagine how many drops that would add up to, it can be pretty big.
Yeah. Well, you better call me in 6 months and find out whether you've done it or not. We have some other callers here. We'll go to Urbana, somebody else in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, when you're talking about wetlands and things like that, in Urbana now, there is a project going on to develop one of the parks into a wetland, partly in response to drainage needs for some new building and also some drainage issues that were in existence in one of the neighborhoods for quite a long time because of when the development was first put into place. The developers really didn't do very much good in terms of drainage. What kinds of opportunities are there for recreating wetlands in places like Florida? And is that a viable option?
Did you say they're taking a park and converting that into a restored wetland?
Yes.
is this like a city park with a playground, or is it a nature park? What kind of park is it?
Right now, well, it's partly a park with like baseball fields and stuff. Mm. Partly it was farmland at one point, and it was donated.
That's very interesting. I haven't heard of that, and I think that's quite interesting that they would take a park and convert that into a wetland. Here in Florida, wetland restoration has a mixed record. There have been some real successes restoring some of the mined out phosphate lands back into wetlands, but there are other scenarios where developers have been allowed to destroy a natural wetland in exchange for the ability to fix a wetland someplace else. And those situations don't seem to be working very well. In other words, the wetland they fix is not as valuable and doesn't work as well doing its job than the one they destroyed. So some of those decisions are actually turning out to be poor decisions. But when you have a vast tract of land like an old phosphate mine where nothing's going on there, and you're able to restore wetland activity, and some of those cases, those have been real success stories.
Well, that's pretty exciting. I just wonder, rather than putting all the research into things like creating the big, huge desalinization plants, whether they might do some more with reestablishing wetlands and also estuary.
Yes, absolutely. And some of those things are going on in Florida, but again, the problem seems to be their deals that allow people to destroy a wetland, a functioning wetland, somewhere else. So the trade-off is just not very good.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you.
That was a great question.
We'll go to this is someone on a cell phone near Lovington, our line number two. Hello.
Hi. How heavily subsidized is your water bill?
Our water bill collectively? I think.
I assume that the federal government's done a lot of. Maybe that has more to do with the West than your area, but obviously the bill you pay isn't the total cost of the water shipped to your house.
No, absolutely. It's a great question, and I actually devote a lot of the book to this question because all federal taxpayers all over the United States subsidized the great water projects of the West that allowed people to, grow sod in the desert. We all paid for these water projects. And on a small scale, your local governments and your state governments often do subsidize a great deal of your water bill. And I argue that that's part of the problem. I think we should all pay the true cost of getting the water from the tap. And that if we did have to pay the true costs, we would, think more about water when we turn on the tap. The way you think about turning down your air conditioner in the summer, you sort of think about that couple $100 bill and you think, well, how far down do I really want to do this? We don't think about that when we're turning on the water tap. And I think we would if the government didn't subsidize water infrastructure to the extent that it does. And another issue that I think is of real interest for people in your area, when you look at the desalination plans, again, often these are happening in the Sun Belt. There was a bill in Congress when I was working on this book that would have given more federal money to Sun Belt states to pay for desalination. And again, that would be sort of repeating the same thing we did 100 years ago when we all paid for these big projects in the West. Now, taxpayers all over the country will be asked to help fund the water supply needed to, quench the population growth moving to the Sun Belt states. And so I think taxpayers should ask these questions. And even Everglades restoration, of course, the country is behind restoring the Everglades for environmental purposes. but I don't know if taxpayers all over the country want their federal tax dollars to be used for a project if its emphasis is just on supplying water to the 7 million people who live in South Florida. I think that's a great question. And again, I talk a lot about price in the book.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Well, how is it actually possible to say something like if people were paying more of the true cost of water,
mm-hmm.
how much more they would be paying on average than what they're paying now?
I don't know if there's an actual percentage. I think that would vary from region to region and even from city to city. But there have been lots of studies out about what economists call the price elasticity of water. And that basically means, you know, the economists ask the question, do people respond to price? You know, water is something that we have to survive. So for a long time, the argument was, well, it wouldn't matter if water costs more. People would still use as much as they want because it's a vital part of life. But the recent research shows that that's not true, that people do respond very well to water pricing. So there's a lot of models you can use to price water that give people incentives to conserve. And again, new economics research shows that people are quite responsive to that.
Let's talk with someone next in the community of Belgium, not too far away from us here in Illinois. Line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, Jim. I would like to point out a couple of interesting things. First off, the area where we are located at, ma'am, Mr. Inge and I are located at, used to be a huge wetlands. It went all the way from Chicago down to essentially Effingham, from the Wabash River, clear over to the Mississippi River. It's
yes.
all growing corn now because we
yes.
drained it all and turned it into cornfields and
yes.
bean fields, which dramatically changed the wetland situation because that was severely replenishing well waters and waters different
yes.
things. But so we've lost a lot of wetlands. It also generated weather, which helped the East have its weather. But I would like to point out more to you that maybe there's something you've missed in the water usage of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the amount of water that flows through a meter that comes into my house that I use for my
mm-hmm.
daily usage.
Mm-hmm.
If you consider the amount of water that goes into making, ethanol that we're going to use for fuel, pasteboard, cardboard,
mm-hmm.
All the other things we use, the amount of water we each individually use is substantially higher than 90 gallons per day, per person per day.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you, and I do write about industrial and agricultural water use in the book. I think we have been talking about what people can do to conserve because, you know, that's something you sort of feel like you have control over it, and it makes you feel like you can take some positive action. But I think it's crucially important that as we debate ethanol and ethanol plants that are, you know, underway both in your part of the country and mine, that water use has to be a key part of that debate. We've got to know how much water is going to be used to grow the corn and to run the plants. I couldn't agree with you more.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm, thank you. We'll go on to Rantoul. This is line number 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for this topic. I find it quite interesting. This might be a little far afield for your guest, but I used to work for an oil company, and I would check out the title on land that they wanted to drill on. And this was in South Louisiana. There was a family that had 600 acres, and the federal government stepped in with no compensation and declared it as wetlands. And I think my question is, in a federal taking like this, since you're taking someone's right, don't you feel that some compensation should be paid?
Are you saying that the federal government took the land from the family and then gave permission to the oil company to drill the wetland?
No.
Okay.
They simply declared it a wetland. The federal government did not touch the land or anything, but by declaring it a wetlands, no one would buy it or lease it or could run cattle on it or grow.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. The federal government didn't take it through eminent domain, but declared it off limits for development, and so the family wasn't able to use it.
Right.
Yes, this happens all over the country, and Florida actually passed a law a few years ago that said if environmental regulators declared something off limits, the property owner could actually sue to get just compensation for what the land would have been worth. And of course that's being challenged by environmentalists. So I think you raise an interesting question about property rights, and that the property rights issues are often coming into play when you talk about wetlands or endangered species or anything else. But I think, you know, I think it's great that the government is, you know, even now in Louisiana, trying to bring some sanity to the overdevelopment and you know, the draining of wetlands that's happened steadily over the past 150 years.
Oh, I agree with you, and so did this particular family. They were, you know, glad to see that you know some measures were being taken, because
yes,
I don't know how it compares to Florida, but I think Louisiana is probably in the top three as far as endangered wetlands.
Yeah, I think they've lost more wetlands than any other part of the country. It was between Florida and Louisiana were one and two.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And let me again introduce our guest, Cynthia Barnett. She's a longtime newspaper and magazine journalist. She's author of a recently published book that's titled Mirage, Florida and the Vanishing Water of the Eastern U.S. It's published by the University of Michigan Press, in which she makes the argument that in the eastern part of the United States, we should not be surprised if in future we start to see problems with shortages of water and conflicts over water, the kinds of things that in the past we've seen a lot in the West, but haven't seen that much in the eastern part of the United States, because it was a resource that was plentiful and people thought that meant it would never be exhausted. And so it has really been over because of increasing demand from individuals and families for development, for industrial use. The resources has been withdrawn much faster than it's been recharge. So if you're interested in reading the book, you can head out to the bookstore or go to the library, look for the book. Questions are also welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We mentioned the industrial use being an issue, and certainly in various places around the country and here where we are, there have been questions about projects where they would build ethanol processing plants that use tremendous amounts of water. Something that maybe people don't think very much about is the bottled water industry and private businesses essentially pumping out the water, putting it in a bottle, and selling it somewhere else. It has become an enormous industry, and I think that in future this commercial exploitation of water resources and water systems is likely to be an increasing issue. It seems that more and more public water systems are being bought up by private companies.
I do have an entire chapter on the bottled water industry, David, and it's a very interesting issue, because the bottled water companies would argue, you know, look, you've been handing your groundwater and your surface water to free to businesses for all of American history. You know, anyone with an electric pump could get as much water as they want. So why are we any different? Why are we any different from a watermelon on the supermarket shelves, a bottle of beer, or all the many products that are used with water as its major ingredient? So the reason I I wrote this chapter is because, you know, in Florida, we citizens are, you know, we know about this groundwater crisis. We're being asked to wean ourselves from groundwater. We're being asked to pay a little bit more for water. And yet at the same time, we are giving water to free, for free to bottled water industries such as, bottled water companies such as Nestle that then turn it into a commodity and sell it back to us for what, a thousand times more. So I write about the difference between how bottled water companies are seen in places like Michigan and Wisconsin and the way they're seen here in the Southeast and sort of what's happening in Maine. And after doing all this research, where I came down was this. I think if we are going to allow bottled water companies to extract this resource, we should simply ask them to pay a little something for it. And this is something that has happened in Maine. I think the name of the company there is Poland Springs. They do have to pay a small, I don't know if they call it a tax or what they call it, but they pay a little something on each gallon they extract. And again, you know, we're being asked to pay more. We're being asked to conserve, and it seems reasonable to ask other businesses, you know, including farmers. They here we still see a lot of inefficient flood irrigation. I think they should have to have a little bit of incentive to conserve, and that we should also get the industrial and business communities to help with this problem.
Do you think one of the things that you note here in the book is that currently, private companies run about a fifth of the mm-hmm. water systems in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something where apparently there is increasing interest of private companies to acquire water systems.
Yes, I think private companies are part of the solution. I think, you know, I think the company is called Aqua America, the largest private water company in the United States, is buying up little water utilities all over the country. A lot of stuff going on in the Southeast, but also they're buying up some utilities around where you are. And the positive thing about that is that they, you know, they tend to be quite efficient, and in many cases they are helping to replace some of the crumbling infrastructure of the waterworks that we see all over the country. This is the number one infrastructure need in the United States. And in some cases, having a private utility can help, you know, fix the pipes and pass the cost on to the consumer. Government doesn't like to do that. They know they'll get voted out of office if they raise our water bill. So I don't think it's unreasonable to have private companies taking over some of our waterworks. But the thing I warn against is the privatization of the water itself. That is, that we would someday see water being traded like pork bellies the way it is in parts of the West. I think that is more of a danger zone, and that private companies have a role to play in our water supply, but that we should be very cautious to make sure that the water itself is always kept in the public trust.
Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have maybe 3-4 minutes left. I guess I'm interested in returning back to the question somebody asked earlier about politics.
Yes.
And about just, you know, to what extent people in, for example, in state government in Florida,
yes,
or any place else,
yes,
are really addressing the issue of trying to responsibly and sustainably manage this key resource, and how it is you manage to balance demands on it, and
mm-hmm.
maybe at some point, you know, if the big issue is development, then you have to say, look, we just cannot have unbridled development, anybody building anything any place they want,
mm-hmm.
as we have in the past. We just can't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's, I'm sure, though, a difficult thing for government if that's linked to, you know, economic developments. It's a difficult thing for government to say, well, we're not going to have that development.
I think think you won't see government in Florida saying we're not going to have that new development. I just don't see it happening. But I think when the developers themselves say, oh my gosh, this is a crisis, I don't have enough water for my golf course or my development, and that's just what's starting to happen now, I think that will be the time when the entire community works together on water issues and environmental issues in a way that not everyone has been involved in the past. But when it comes to politics, I have a quote in the book from the late Senator Simon from your area, and he, you know, people always say, oh, it's so far-fetched that the Great Lakes water would someday, for example, be tapped by people in the Sun Belt. And he said it always came back to politics. His quote was, when people of Illinois say that they would never tolerate that, well, senators from Illinois who want to get projects approved had better go along with high priorities for senators from the Southwest states, or they won't get projects approved for Illinois. It's not that complicated when it gets to the United States Senate. So, you know, here was someone who knew so much about water, who was so sort of up on this issue and other environmental issues, you know, putting it in that blunt political term. And, you know, that's sort of a shocking statement, and I think it does come down to politics.
Yeah,
he knew that.
He was a great man. It was a great loss, and I'm not exactly sure when he said that, but
he said it in the year 2000.
It was any time recently. So this was something that he was paying attention to a long time ago.
He wrote a fantastic book I would recommend to your listeners even now. It's called Tapped Out, and it was about the global water crisis, but he truly put it into terms that we Americans can understand. It's a great read. I would recommend it.
Yeah, and that also says something about how, and you certainly deal with it in part, at least in passing in the book, about how how the power balance has shifted regionally in the United States, where it has shifted to, and that that's also where there's been great population growth, but it just happens to be that it's in some of the most arid parts of the country, and there is tremendous demand for water, and people have managed to take their political clout and to translate that into ways to satisfy that demand. So, you know, when you read something like that from Paul Simon, you can't just brush that off.
No, you can't. You can't. Yeah, right now, southern and western states have a 252 to 183 edge, and that is going to widen as population shifts from the Northeast and Midwest to the South and the entire Sun Belt.
And again, going back to this question of what people can do on the individual level, I mean, that's when we always seem to come back. We're talking about something like this. We always come back to that question, like, well, okay, what do you expect? You know, what can I do? Well, it is, as we have said, people can work on conservation. They can work on reducing their use. So in a place where, like Florida, has there been any kind of concerted educational campaign to convince people to be more conscious
of
water use?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question, because, yes, so much money has been spent on public education campaigns and pamphlets, and you're just always seeing this stuff on the billboards and in your mailbox. And yet many people don't seem to be paying any attention. And sometimes I wonder if it's the retiree population, people sort of set in their ways, who want to live in a gated subdivision full of sod. Because we still have many places like that. But there is a lot of public education. And, in fact, I talk a lot about this county called Sarasota County. It's in southwest Florida, absolutely beautiful. They have been one county that really put strict water use laws on the books. Back when we had our last drought in 2001, they said, well, we've already made all these people mad about watering their lawns, not being able to water the lawns. Let's just keep these on the books, and then we won't have to go through it again next time there's a drought. Well, the result has been incredible. Our statewide per capita water use is 174 gallons per day. This one county has gotten its water use down to 90 gallons per capita per day. You know, Yes, they have strict yard watering restrictions, but that's about it. And they have some of the most beautiful lawns in all of Florida. They're xeriscaped. There's only a certain amount of sod you're allowed to have, and you have to have micro-irrigation. You can irrigate your lawn. You simply have to be smart about it, and that's had a dramatic impact. So I think that's a real sign that we could do this on a much larger basis all over the East.
Well, there we'll have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. You want to read more on this issue, look for the book. It's Mirage, Florida and the Vanishing Water of the Eastern U.S. It's published by the University of Michigan Press by our guest, Cynthia Barnett. She's a reporter for Florida Trend Magazine. So thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me on today, David. It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to WILL.UIUC.EDU. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 25th anniversary of offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana. Bodywork Associates now has an office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union.
It's 3 minutes before 12 noon, and that wraps up Focus 580 for today. The Afternoon Magazine coming up next. I'm Jay Pierce. Celeste Quinn is off. We will have an archived interview in the 1 o'clock hour that Celeste conducted back in February with David Elkind. Dr. Elkind is professor of child development in the Elliott Pearson Department of Child Development at Tufts University and the author of The Power of Play, How Spontaneous Imaginative Activities Lead to Happier, Healthier Children. That's coming up at 1:06. In the meantime, we have our usual noon hour of news and information for you, and we'll begin it with a look at how the markets are doing just before noon today. In Kansas City, September wheat at 656.5 is up 8.5. The December contract at 672.5 up 8, just changed to 672.25 up 8 even. September wheat on the Chicago Board of Trade, 672.25 up 9.75. December at 691.5 up 9, and March at 686 up 6.5. September corn, 340.5 up 5.25. December at 357 up 5. The March contract at 372.25 up 4.75. And December 08 wheat in Chicago at 403.75 up 4.25. August soybeans, 854 up 15.5. The September soybeans at 860 are up 13. November 876.25 up 13.5. And November at 876.25 up 13.75. Soybean meal for August, 229.50 up 350. August soybean oil, 37.22 up 50. The August feeder cattle, 114.65 down 7.5. August live cattle, 91.80 down 10. And the October live cattle, 95.80 down 7.5. August lean hogs, 75.02.5, currently down 5. Crude oil for September, 72.25 a barrel, down 17 cents. October, 72.04, down 34 cents. The CRB index up 0.84 at 313.60. The dollar's down 0.24 at 80.34. And the Dow Jones Industrials are down 98 points.